Celebrating a century of progress, the FBI.
We of the FBI feel that we're a part of a team to make America a great and decent place in which to live. We're on that team, all of us, together.
If J. Edgar Hoover was the first coach of Team America, what position do you play? 100 years of point guards and slam dunks for the world's police. America. Bleep, yeah. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 25th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adora Udoji. Barack Obama talks about walls coming down, but what walls are going up? The L.A. Dodgers turn 50, and so does the heartache for da bums. We talk to the most wanted man at the FBI, the woman putting together the first ever convention for bloggers of color, and we look at how just a few words can sum up almost anything.
Leap, yeah.
Those stories and the rest of the day's news. A Qantas flight heading from Australia to London was forced to make an emergency landing in the Philippines after something blew a hole in its side. Authorities discovered the 9-foot-wide hole in the body of the 747 near the right wing. The jet plunged 20,000 feet before landing safely. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says Pakistan needs to do more to prevent militants from crossing into Afghanistan.
Pakistan does need to do more. That border, we understand that it's difficult. We understand that the northwest frontier area is difficult, but militants cannot be allowed to organize there and to plan there and to engage across the border.
U.S. commanders in Afghanistan have been asking for more troops because of the rising violence.
In his open-air speech to an estimated 200,000 people in Berlin yesterday, Barack Obama urged Europeans and Americans to defeat terror together.
This threat is real, and we cannot shrink from our responsibility to combat it.
The candidate is in Paris today. Meanwhile, Republican John McCain had lunch at a German restaurant in Berlin, Ohio yesterday. He told reporters he'll save European trips for later.
I'd much prefer to do it as president of the United States rather than as a candidate for the office of presidency.
McCain heads to Colorado today to meet with the Tibetan Dalai Lama.
More than 250,000 people are still without power as the rains from Hurricane Dolly came to an end. The total damage is estimated to be about $750 million. Much of the cotton crop in the Rio Grande Valley may be lost. And in Beijing, the last round of Olympic tickets are going on sale. Thousands of people have been lining up. With temperatures in the 90s, hundreds of police have struggled to maintain order.
Oil's up a few dollars a barrel, 126 in trading. The Dow lost 2.5%. The S&P lost 2% yesterday. Begins trading at 1252, the S&P does. What can you say in a very few words about a very big event? Wall Street got drunk. That's what the president said about the financial crisis. It's pithy. We want to hear your few-word characterizations of major league historical incidents like the Great Depression, like the oil crisis. Call us at 877-8-MY. My take quickly. Few words on The Takeaway. Good morning, everybody. We begin with candidate Barack Obama, who spoke yesterday before a crowd of 200,000 people in Berlin. We've been talking about the speech all week. And when he spoke yesterday in Germany, he revived a metaphor which may be familiar to you students of history out there.
The greatest danger of all is to allow new walls to divide us from one another. The walls between old allies on either side of the Atlantic cannot stand. The walls between the countries with the most and those with the least cannot stand. The walls between races and tribes, natives and immigrants, Christians and Muslims and Jews cannot stand. These now are the walls we must tear down.
Walls, powerful, concepts for a city, Berlin. When presidents spoke there in the past, Ronald Reagan and JFK, there was literally a wall between East and West Germany. But we wanted to invite Stephen Erlanger, New York Times correspondent in Paris, to discuss what new walls actually are going up between the United States and our allies in Europe that may represent something of a strategic and geopolitical shift in the region that the next president will definitely have to deal with and perhaps will be a theme for all this century. We're joined by Stephen Erlanger from Paris. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks.
You know, when Reagan and President Kennedy spoke in Berlin, it was a fairly easy bipolar world. There was the East, there was the West, there was Europe versus the Soviet bloc and all of the proxies. Now it seems as though Europe is as much a rival of the United States as an ally, and there are even other groupings beginning to form, political and otherwise, which could mix things up a bit. How do you see this notion of walls and rivalries between Europe and the United States?
Well, Obama talked about a lot of walls, but there's another German metaphor which still exists in Berlin, which is called the wall in the head. I mean, concrete walls, brick walls go down, but walls in the head tend to remain. And that's true in Germany today as well. And I think it is also true between, you know, Eastern Europe and Russia, for instance. Between America and Europe, what you've had is really 8 years of bad feelings and bad temper. The second Bush administration has been more emollient. But the first Bush administration with Guantanamo, with the open decision to abandon the Geneva Convention on prisoners' rights, the ridicule of the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty, all this struck the Europeans as very ideological, as driven by a kind of neocon notion of the world and not their idea of the world. And so this remains, and any new president's going to have to deal with it, and it's going to take more than a tone poem to sort of get over
right.
it. Part of the problem, of course, is that there is economic rivalry. I mean, the United States and the European Union, these 27 countries share values, they share belief in the rule of law.
And the strongest currency in the world.
Well, exactly. You know, and biggest problem is, of course, the American debt rather than European economic strength. But there are more people living in this bloc than live in the United States. The economy is, I believe, bigger. It gives much more foreign aid to the rest of the world. It is not united as one political entity, but it is a kind of new experiment in shared sovereignty and in issues as real as relations with Turkey or Russia, or as sometimes pathetic or tiny as the issue of American poultry imports into Europe. There are different sets of rules and understandings. The European Union has set up a whole set of its own trading rules and regulations, its oversight of American investment into Europe, which is rubbing the United States sometimes the wrong way.
Let's talk about some of the new experiments for just a second. Sarkozy has this Mediterranean cooperation group that he sort of inaugurated within the past month. And you alluded to Russia earlier. What temptations are there for Europe to create multilateral alliances or connections with Russia as it ascends as a energy power in the world, second only to Saudi Arabia?
Well, Europe has long been dependent on Russian energy, particularly natural gas, and actually during the Reagan years, which you mentioned before, the United States tried to stop the Europeans from having a pipeline to Russia that went through Germany. That dependence is real, and it is in Washington's eyes, and would probably be true in any new president's eyes, an argument against the Europeans standing up to Russian claims on its former Soviet Union territory, for example, Georgia, Abkhazia. There's a whole fight going on about Russian influence in the former Soviet, now independent country of Georgia. And the Americans are very confrontational with the Russians about it. The Americans want to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. The Germans, the French, the British are saying, wait, not so fast. We don't want to annoy the new Russian president, Medvedev. It's not clear these countries will be good partners in NATO. Let's put it all off. The same is with Turkey. The United States thinks its great ally, its relatively moderate Muslim state democracy, Turkey, should be in the European Union, as the European Union promised years ago to bring Turkey in. But France and other countries are dead set against it.
Well, again, so a complexity that's going to require, as you said so aptly a moment ago, more than a tone poem. Stephen, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to do it.
Stephen Erlanger is the New York Times correspondent in Paris. A lot of tone poetic walls.
I love the phrase tone poem.
I think that could be the takeaway for today.
Well, in fact, that, I was just going to say, is his brief description of that speech. Gas prices continued to climb at the pump this week, I'm sure you noticed, but the partisan energy wrangling has continued. House Republicans defeated an effort yesterday by the Democrats to dip into the federal emergency stockpile of oil. And Republicans, of course, would rather see us drilling for new barrels. This is the fourth Democratic-sponsored energy bill that has failed since June. We're going to turn now to Todd Zwillick. He is a correspondent and anchor for Capital News Connection in Washington. Hey, Todd, aren't these guys in the majority? Why can't they get a bill passed?
It's a great question. Actually, we need to talk about procedure for a second, if
no.
I might. Don't glaze over. No, but this is the answer to the question, though.
Okay.
It's about procedure, and it's actually kind of interesting. What the Democrats have been doing on these energy bills that you mentioned have been defeated is bringing them up under a procedure called suspension.
And why are they doing that?
They're doing it because suspension bills cannot be amended. And the reason you do that is because you keep pesky Republican amendments off of your bills. Here's the reason why. Republicans know if they get a chance to offer one of their amendments on any of these energy bills, it'll be on drilling, mostly probably opening up drilling on the outer continental shelf, deep sea drilling. That'll pass. There's enough Democratic support to pass that. The leadership does not want to risk that embarrassment, so they bring bills up under suspension. Now, here's the risk, though. That's the benefit of suspension.
Yeah, uh-huh.
The risk, it has to pass by two-thirds. They don't have enough votes to pass by two-thirds because you need Republican support. So they keep bringing these things up. Look, we're bringing up energy bills. We're bringing up federal stockpile, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We're bringing up windfall tax for oil companies.
Here's what I never understand. It almost sounds like one of those custody battles where people lose sight of the fact that they actually love their kid. I mean, people want to offer – the Congress should want to offer relief for consumers at the gas pump. But they're so busy quarreling over how that's going to happen and the way to do that, that it never happens.
Yeah, you're right. That's because at this stage in the election cycle for most members of Congress, right before an election, is the equivalent of the $10 million divorce with the big mansion. I mean, who's going to give?
Don't tell me who the trophy wife
is. Except Bush gets all the credit for oil prices dropping to $124 a barrel. The Democrats have just sat and allowed Bush to say, hey, the moment I started talking about drilling, boom, we had a oil depression.
Yeah, and the Democrats say the moment they started talking about reining in speculation, prices dropped by $10 a barrel. I personally don't think the Democrats necessarily lose on that theoretical argument because their argument, and I think most of the public believes and understands, that Cheney, Bush, two oil men in the White House up to now have been pretty friendly to the industry. We can't blame oil prices on them directly. That's not credible. But the argument both ways, I think most people probably side with the Democrats that, hey, it's not necessarily the president who's brought down oil prices here.
All right, Todd, brevity is the watchword for today at The Takeaway. So quickly, very succinctly, what are we going to see happen in the next week or so on this?
The Senate's going to be voting over the weekend. Harry Reid is keeping them in, and they're going to be voting on another procedural motion. Sorry, today.
I'm asleep.
That'll go
Todd.
Over the weekend.
We got to go.
Okay.
I'm asleep.
Sorry.
Now we have to do our form of suspension. Thank you so much, Todd. Todd Zwillick, he's a correspondent and anchor for Capital News Connection. We've got news coming up here on The Takeaway.
Good morning, everybody. Think of a crisis, an enormous kind of global fiasco of one kind or another, kind of hone it down to just a few words and call 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us your sort of 4, 5, 6 word encapsulation of some global phenomenon like the Great Depression or something like that. That's what we're talking about on The Takeaway today. My take at thetakeaway.org is if you want to reach us by email. I'm being dragged kicking and screaming as a longtime resident of Brooklyn, New York, into the next segment. The next sound that you're about to hear is deeply painful to me, but if you're a Los Angeles Dodgers fan, it just might be your favorite baseball moment.
And now the only question was, could he make it around the base paths unassisted?
She is gone. That's what people of Brooklyn might say about the Brooklyn Dodgers, who left long ago, 1957, for Los Angeles. That's Kirk Gibson's historic home run against the Oakland A's in the 1988 playoffs, long after the Dodgers have become a Los Angeles icon. Gibson was on the bench with hamstring and knee problems, you may recall, but limped to the plate. That's what the caller is referring to there, and hit a home run into the right field stands. It was a Game 1 victory. But the reason we play that tape for you and talk about the Dodgers is that on Sunday, much to the chagrin of residents of Brooklyn, Walter O'Malley, the man who took the Dodgers to L.A., is going to be enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's an institution he helped pay for as one of the barons of the game. O'Malley may not be loved in New York, but he is certainly beloved in Los Angeles. He brought baseball to the West Coast. Kitty Feldy, a special correspondent with Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, joins us from Los Angeles. Kitty, congratulations.
Hey, you know, Kirk Gibson is our hero. I have to correct you, though. You know, it was 58
when the
Brooklyn Dodgers became the Los Angeles Dodgers.
That's right.
And that collar, this shows you how long it's been. That's Vin Scully. He's been with the Dodgers since 1950.
No, it's crazy. I was listening to the sound from all of that time. I mean, there's so much Vin Scully. I mean, this really does span my lifetime. I was born in 56. My first memories of my grandparents are talking about the Dodgers going.
Well, my first audio memory is also it's Vin Scully calling one of the first games from the Coliseum out here in Los Angeles. So that would have been 1958. It's the first thing I remember. My father cutting the grass, the smell of the grass, the sound of his red transistor radio, and that voice of Vin Scully. It's what we know here in Los Angeles. My heart breaks for all of you back in New York.
No, it doesn't.
But then the Los You're right, Catherine.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Exactly, yeah.
Hey, Kitty, you
it
know,
doesn't.
One thing that I didn't know, there was a young woman who was actually instrumental in making this move happen. I don't think a lot of people know that.
She is a fascinating character. So fascinating, I put her in a musical about the Dodgers' move to Los Angeles. Her name is Roz Wyman, and these days she is a powerhouse with the Democratic Party. When Dianne Feinstein comes to California, in Southern California, she stays at Roz Wyman's house. She will be at the National Convention in Denver, where she has been for more than 50 years. When she was 22 years old, she was a USC grad, and she decided she would run for city council. And she had a little piece of campaign literature, and one of the things she put down there was, and let's bring Major League Baseball to Los Angeles. She got elected, and then she had to figure out how to do that.
Well, she got some help, that's for sure. Walter O'Malley was the person who was convinced, and partly by, you know, the intransigence of the establishment in New York to bring the team to L.A. Let's talk a little bit about Walter, who's going into the Hall of Fame on Sunday. How is he remembered in Los Angeles?
Well, he's remembered as the man who brought Major League Baseball to Los Angeles. You know, there is, you know, while Brooklyn has been pissed off at him for half a century, there is a group of residents out here who have been angry with him for just as long, for not quite the right reasons. The place where Walter O'Malley decided he wanted to place his Dodgers, he saw this from a helicopter ride. He's looking over Los Angeles, looking for vacant land, and he looks down and says, "What's that?" We're not quite sure that's really what he said, but that's the tale at any rate. And what that was that he was pointing to was an area that had been scheduled for public housing after the war. And it fell apart. The deal fell apart in part because real estate interests in Los Angeles didn't like the idea of the feds getting involved with paying for housing, in part because they implicated the city housing guy in charge. They accused him of being a communist. So city housing failed. The city was stuck with this land. But there had been residents on that land before the housing was being built, and a lot of people were displaced.
Baseball
and those residents.
Politics, it's a tough mix. Here's actually the voice of Walter O'Malley talking about similar problems financially in Brooklyn, the place he escaped from.
We wanted to stay in Brooklyn, but we had exhausted a 10-year campaign to make it possible for us to buy land and to build a ballpark with adequate parking. When we struck out on that, it appeared that we had our choice of going to San Francisco or Los Angeles.
That's Walter speaking in the 1970s. What a character.
He was quite the man. He was, as they said, an old Irishman, a tale teller. You know, this bite continues where he says, you know, I said to Horace Stoneham, who owned the New York Giants, that, you know, we both need to move and that you can have your choice of New York or Los Angeles. And he wanted, he can have San Francisco or Los Angeles. And Horace Stoneham said, I'll take San Francisco, and that's why I moved to L.A. Well, you know, that wasn't the truth, but that was the way he told the story.
Yeah.
He already knew he had a deal brewing in Los Angeles.
Well, the pain,
and Horace Stoneham just...
The pain continues, Kitty. I hate to interrupt you. You know, Joe Torre is out there now, and the Dodgers are on fire. So good luck in the postseason. Thanks for joining us.
You bet, John.
Kitty Feldy, special correspondent with Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, talking about the Dodgers going to L.A. 50 years ago, and Walter O'Malley goes into the Hall of Fame.
You know, I thought you were very brave.
Brave?
You did that well.
Thank you. I'm going to cry now. Femi, it's up to you. Take us out.
Thanks a lot. 28 minutes past the hour, Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington is blocking three nominations to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. She says the commission, and I quote, has dropped the ball in regulating oil markets. Federal regulators say the operator of a collapsed Utah mine violated safety regulations. The operator cut coal pillars that should have been left standing to prevent cave-ins. Six miners and three rescuers died in the collapse last summer. And the State Department is investigating allegations that some of its employees may have encouraged lucrative oil deals between Iraq and several Western companies. Now, 350 people on board a Qantas Airlines jumbo jet are very glad to be alive today. The plane was flying from London to Australia via Hong Kong when oxygen masks dropped from the ceiling and the jet plunged 20,000 feet. The plane made an emergency landing in Manila, the Philippines. Now, the airport authorities in Manila found a hole near the fuselage that was 9 feet wide. Some of the passengers were throwing up as they left the plane.
And on that note...
Oh, sorry. Tasteful.
Thank you.
And on that
Thank
chunky
you,
note,
Femi.
I will leave you.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. I'm in for Adore Udoji today. A reminder that we are looking for your quick take on any sort of major event or global event. President Bush was able to sum up the crisis on Wall Street by saying simply, Wall Street got drunk. Well, we'd like to know how you would sum up some major events. So go to 877-8-MY-TAKE or go online, mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Well, John, you can say this about J. Edgar Hoover. He was very, very clear about the mission statement of the FBI.
We must not for a moment lose sight of our goal to teach the criminal that regardless of his subterfuges, his squirming, his twisting and slimy wriggling, he cannot escape the one inexorable rule of law enforcement. You can't get away with it.
Was he wearing a dress when he said that?
You know, I confess that I've always wondered that. Squirming, twisty, slimy. Well, here's one thing you can't get away with. You can't get away from the FBI's 100th birthday. It happens tomorrow. And these days, the most wanted man at the Bureau, okay, couldn't resist that, is its lone historian, Dr. John Fox. He joins us from Washington. Dr. Fox, the beginnings
Good morning.
Of...
Thank you.
Good morning. The beginnings of the FBI were actually rather humble. How many men were gathered?
In the beginning, it was only 34. It was an experiment in light of a recent law that Congress had passed saying that the Secret Service could not loan out detectives to the rest of the federal government. It put the Attorney General in a real bind.
So, in other words, it actually began with the interdepartmental squabbling.
Well, I don't know about interdepartmental, but certainly legislative and executive.
And the connection to Bonaparte, I was fascinated to hear this.
Well, Charles Bonaparte was the grandnephew of Napoleon. A little ironic, perhaps, you know, French dictator, U.S. civil servant. But the Bonaparte family in Baltimore had been there for many generations, and apparently there was some kind of squabble back in Napoleon's day that led to them coming to America.
Now, probably the most florid part of the FBI history was the gangster era. That was also around the time that Congress got around to officially recognizing it as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Tell me, how fair is it to say that gangsters actually made the FBI what they are?
Well, in many ways, it's very fair, really. The FBI became known as a law enforcement organization in the 1930s. Prior to that, they were largely unknown. They had very little public exposure, in a sense. Part of it was there were very few federal criminal laws to investigate. Part of it was the crime of the 1920s was prohibition, and that was a Treasury Department responsibility.
Hey, and of course, one of the most famous cases, of course, would be John Dillinger. Listen to this newsreel from 1934.
John Dillinger is dead, trapped at last, and shot down in his tracks as he emerged from this motion picture theater here in Chicago. Tipped off to the gangsters' movements by a woman, federal agents surrounded the theater with a ring of steel, blue steel, and itching trigger fingers. He tried to draw his gun, but three bullets fired simultaneously ended his notorious career.
Why don't we have news like that anymore?
Right. Brevity is not a feature.
Now,
it was certainly colorful.
Now, Dr. Fox, what artifacts from that time does the Bureau keep? What have you stumbled
over?
Wait.
Before we leave Dillinger, is it true what they say about Dillinger, Dr. Fox?
Probably not if I'm thinking of what you're thinking.
All right, yeah, and you are, and we don't need to go there. Okay, continue.
You just had to bring that in, didn't you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
As for artifacts, actually, we do have some, and they're on display in D.C. at the moment over at the Newseum. We've got the hat that Dillinger was wearing the night he was killed, his glasses, the gun he was carrying, and we have some other artifacts from his gang and from others of the era.
Well, what did you stumble over most recently?
Well, that was the gun that Dillinger was carrying the night he was killed. It had been a part of our tour for decades, and in the changing of the tour and closing of it, it had gotten misplaced. And we were looking for other artifacts, and I found it in a box of miscellaneous guns.
That's great. I mean, you could have a real tag sale there at the federal government if you can find stuff like that just by looking through boxes. You know, I'm wondering if the heroic kind of mythology, and it's fascinating and irresistible, of the FBI of the J. Edgar Hoover era gets tainted or tarnished in some way with all of the sort of rethinking of the FBI's mission post 9/11.
I don't know if it, I certainly wouldn't say it was tainted in any way, because of course we have really from the beginning we have had responsibilities both for investigating crimes under the federal criminal law and investigating certain national security matters. At one time or another, our criminal mission comes to the forefront, like in the gangster era. Today, of course, it's national security. Counterterrorism, preventing terrorist attacks, is our top priority. And so throughout our history, we swing back and forth between those two things. Not that we don't do the other and continue to do it strongly, but that we have both missions at the same time.
Quickly, as we wrap this up, talk about interest in this birthday. Who have you heard from, both in this country and abroad?
There's been interest worldwide. Of course, all the major news venues, from TV to radio to Turner Classic Movies did an FBI movie night last night, to overseas, many European journalists, many others going as far as Korea and Asia have been interested. Really, the FBI captures the imagination of the world over and has done so since the 1930s.
All right. Dr. Fox, I want to thank you for joining us. That's Dr. John Fox, the most wanted man these days with the 100th birthday of the FBI. He is its lone historian. We're going to turn now to our lone news anchor, Femi Oke. Give us the headlines.
Hello there. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour. Seven low-intensity bombs exploded across Bangalore, India today. One person was killed and at least 15 people were wounded. Congressional investigators are recommending that the State Department develop, and I quote, a comprehensive long-term strategy to meet the rising demand for passports. Things are getting back to normal in South Texas now that Hurricane Dolly has almost gone. More than 200,000 people are still without power, and officials are concerned about downed power lines. Barack Obama is in France today for talks with Nicolas Sarkozy, that's the French president, and John McCain will address a military convention in Denver and meet with the Dalai Lama in Aspen, Colorado. And with just 2 weeks until the start of the Summer Olympics, the last batch of tickets in China went on sale today. Have a listen to this. There were chaotic scenes with people trying to get their two tickets. That was all they were allowed, pushing past the police, thousands of people standing in line. Temperatures were in the high 90s. The BBC's Daniel Griffiths joined the lines in Beijing this morning.
On a hot, smoggy morning, thousands of people from all over China queued to buy the remaining tickets for the Olympics. Many of them had waited for days, sleeping outside on mats or in deck chairs. Tempers flared in the intense heat, with people shouting and surging forward.
There were 820,000 tickets on sale this morning in China. You're only allowed to have two tickets each. And some people had stayed in line for 24 hours to get their two tickets.
Did you get anything?
It was a bit of a long commute to work.
What event? Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, we all get a little more candid when we think no one's listening.
Wall Street got drunk. That's one of the reasons I actually turned off the TV cameras.
You can just hear it. That's our president saying Wall Street got drunk. He was talking to 400 people at a closed-door fundraiser last week. He asked people to turn off their video cameras, but someone captured it on a phone, and the rest, of course, is YouTube history. Wall Street got drunk. The global credit crisis explained in four words, or perhaps it's an epitaph, which kind of got us to thinking.
Well, that maybe there are some other spontaneous off-the-cuff characterizations of, you know, total fiasco, disaster, impending doom.
There must be.
Okay, how about this one? Herbert Hoover. Remember his famous quote about the Depression? A passing incident in our national lives.
Well, he sure nailed it. General George Custer reportedly said to his officers just before his demise at Little Bighorn, "We caught them napping," referring to the Indians who would slaughter his troops a few hours later.
Yeah, I guess they did.
Ouch.
How about this? This is a goodie. Nixon's off-the-cuff answer to the difficulties of Watergate.
Well, I'm not a crook.
There is this famous line by astronaut Jim Lovell on Apollo 13 while he was watching his oxygen spew out into space after a mysterious explosion.
Many of us might remember it from the movie Apollo 13 when Tom Hanks said,
"Houston, we have a problem."
Problem or not, NASA is responsible for a few of these instant slogans. This one's a little sobering. There was the reaction to the 1986 Challenger explosion live and in real time.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
It was an explosion,
that.
Of course. We can't exactly call lines from Hollywood movies off the cuff. But I personally love this prison boss's explanation for needing to beat his inmates with a shovel. It's from the movie Cool Hand Luke.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Says it all right there.
Yes, it does. So. You know, I think, though, the topper has to be, in terms of describing a harrowing experience, J. Robert Oppenheimer's reaction to seeing the first atomic explosion, quoting the Hindu god Vishnu.
"Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
Of course, Oppenheimer knew the world was listening to him at that point, so his candor is maybe a bit of captioning there. Anyway, we asked you to create your own slogans or short explainers for a global crisis of your choosing, and here's what some of you came up with.
This is Mary Elizabeth Williams, culture critic for The Takeaway, and here's my six words on the French Revolution. Guess they didn't want the cake.
Here's a guest, Ian Johnson, who referred to a story we did last week.
Ian Johnson from Out Now. South Carolina's politicians, so not gay.
He's talking about an ad campaign. South Carolina's so gay, it caused all kinds of controversy. That sums it up right there.
All right. This is a possibility for a new bumper sticker.
Hello, my name is Dominic DePinto. I'm from Tewksbury, New Jersey, and my take on a global disaster is meteors and dinosaurs don't mix. Bye now.
Talking about the extinction of the dinosaurs. Yes, indeed. What about the extinction of bees? It's a crisis for beekeepers. Here's what one of you said.
Hi, this is Kim Flottam, editor of Bee Culture Magazine in Medina, Ohio. The crisis is colony collapse disorder, and your six words are, honeybees leave, but they never return.
It almost sounds like an ad. Okay, and forget lions and tigers
quickly.
And bears.
Well, lots of people talked about the global warming. Actually, Barrett, we'll play it later, said, "Oil suburbs and Hummers, oh my." That sums up global warming. But you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Wall Street got drunk.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adore Udoji, and now we're going to turn to Femi Oke and the latest news.
Thanks, Catherine. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. In central New Hampshire, one person died and a dozen or so were injured from violent storms, which may have included a tornado. The Secret Service is asking for an extra $9.5 million to cover unexpected costs of protecting the presidential candidates this year. And more than 50 dissident Catholic groups have published an unusually frank open letter to Pope Benedict, urging him to lift the church's ban on contraception. They say it's been catastrophic. And finally, passengers on a Qantas Airways flight are glad to be back on the ground. They were flying from London to Melbourne, Australia. The plane made an emergency landing, dropping 20,000 feet. And once on the ground, a 9-foot-wide hole was discovered. Just got some sound together of what happened and the passengers' reaction.
There was an almighty crack. You could hear something happening, and then the oxygen masks fell down, and you started dropping down, ears popping, that sort of stuff.
My partner was upstairs. I thought maybe he's gone. I don't know. I had no idea. I knew there was a hole somewhere, but I didn't know what was going on.
Yes! Extremely scared.
Oh, you really feel for that little young one there. The airport authorities say that the ceiling around the hole had collapsed and the floor had also given way, and they are investigating to see what happened.
Well, there's a Boeing engineer who's feeling very happy this morning, I suspect. More than one.
Yeah, everybody got down safely.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right, we turn now to Baghdad. The American Embassy in Baghdad announced on Thursday that it has expanded by tenfold a program to help Iraqi employees of the U.S. government in Iraq to obtain visas and ultimately achieve citizenship in the United States. These Iraqis face deadly threats because of their work, and many of them have died in the course of doing that work. Joining us now is Alyssa Johansson-Rubin, a New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. Alyssa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, it seems that this is really long overdue, and I think to some Americans it might seem shocking that such an arrangement in a dangerous conflict zone like this wouldn't come automatically with the promise of citizenship under most circumstances. Why the delay?
Well, it partly is a matter of just the sheer bureaucracy of the American immigration system and some of the new security requirements since 2001. The Department of Homeland Security requires that everyone go through really extensive background checks. So there's great delays. But I think there also was a very serious lag in understanding the severity of the threat to employees of the American government, the American military, but also of any Americans here in Iraq. I mean, including the New York Times and other media organizations. It took a while for people to recognize what a problem it was. I think arguably some of us who lived out in the city of Baghdad understood that sooner. But after all, the embassy is in the green zone, and the military also, I think, just wasn't cognizant of it. To the military's credit, a lot of individual officers did understand it and worked very hard to get more liberal policies for their translators.
It sounds like you're saying that it got lost in the sort of mythological supposition that Americans would be welcomed with open arms as liberators, and that U.S. citizenship wouldn't necessarily be a preference of the workers. How many Iraqis does this affect in this policy changing? I believe starting today.
Right. Well, I think it actually already started at least a week or so ago, but it was officially announced. It's a little complicated, but it's 5,000 people a year who are current who have worked for the American embassy here in Baghdad or elsewhere in Iraq. They have other outposts or the American military or for USAID projects. But each of those 5,000 can bring a small number of relatives with them, spouses, children, for instance, their more distant relatives, like their, for instance, instance, just siblings or siblings' children, that sort of thing, might be able to come under a kind of accelerated program. So how many will ultimately, the knock-on effect could be considerable. So I think we don't know. It's a minimum of 5,000 a year, but
right.
I think that it's almost certainly going to be much closer to 2 to 3 times that number.
Well, certainly overdue in the heroic work that a lot of the Iraqis have been doing for U.S. troops and even for journalists there in Baghdad. Alyssa Johansson-Rubin, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, glad to do it.
Alyssa Rubin is New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. We should note, even though the program is a liberalization, it'll still be tight. The average Iraqi household is estimated to have about 6 people in it. That's according to the International Organization for Migration. Catherine?
Is there such a thing as segregation on the net? For the first time, bloggers of color from around the world are going to be gathering for the first Blogging While Brown conference in Atlanta. Blogger and conference organizer Gina McCauley joins us now from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Hey, Gina, welcome. I thought one of the beauties of the internet was that you had access to a pulpit without your race, creed, color, or gender getting in the way. You just needed a keyboard. So how is there racial disparity among bloggers?
I don't know that it's so much racial disparity, but people tend to congregate around people that they have things in common with. And so as the internet has developed with no boundaries, people have actually, informally segregated themselves for what, I don't like the term segregated, but they've congregated around people who have the same interests and goals and viewpoints.
You're making it sound almost analogous to the tales people tell about school lunchrooms where, well, no one makes it this way, but the black kids go to one side, the white kids go to the other side.
Absolutely. And when it's not everything. There is some overlap. I read all different kinds of blogs. But the problem is, as blogs tend to become more powerful and, in fact, become economic agents where people are making money from them, that disparity in begins to be more significant to people, because then it starts affecting the power that they're able to wield and the money that they're able to make. And in this country, I think it's been a longstanding principle that separate is inherently unequal. And so that's one of the biggest complaints tend to be outgrowths of the political blogosphere, because, as you know, in the recent years, progressive bloggers have been declaring that they're going to establish a new world order. Well, oftentimes those blogs don't necessarily represent the viewpoints or the makeup of the current order. And so my question is, if you're going to create a new world order and become more powerful and replace something, what are you replacing it with? And I think it's a legitimate concern as to whether or not the voices at the table reflect
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about the mechanism of that alleged new world order. How do you think influence proceeds on the net? And speaking from your own experience, is a blog influential because it represents a community, or because its text and content is so persuasive that it pulls people in some way, in your experience?
In my experience with my own blog, I was just blogging, and my content or what I was doing drew people to me. So I think that definitely is true. I don't think it's something you set out to do to be powerful.
And we should mention your website, which is whataboutourdaughters.blogspot.com.
Yes, or whataboutourdaughters.com. And I just started expressing my own viewpoints and then took on my own little personal crusade against the major television network, and it got picked up by mainstream media. And then, of course, all of the people who had any grievances against that network for over 20 years flocked to me. So
you think you're more intimidating as a blogger than as someone who just writes letters to the editor?
Oh, most definitely. Someone who writes a letter to the editor, I don't like the word intimidating, but someone who writes a letter to the editor reaches the readers of that particular journal. But a blogger, and this has never happened in the history of the world, a single individual with the click of a button can reach the entire world. You are your own radio station. You are your own television station. You are your own newspaper.
Okay.
You have a worldwide reach.
Gina McCauley, whataboutourdaughters.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
You know, I like her. I think she is intimidating. I think it's good. I think it's good about the net. Anyway, we're always on here at The Takeaway, and boy, we are so intimidating. You can find us online streaming at Friend Feed on Facebook. Come around to thetakeaway.org and visit.
And, of course, we're talking today to the most wanted man at the FBI as the agency turns 100. And is there segregation on the Internet?
Just spoke about that. Wall Street got drunk. You can send us your six-word slogans for global disaster. You don't have to be a president.
The French Revolution. People lost their heads.
Okay. Good one, Barbara. Seven words.
From a Dutch in New Jersey.
We'll take it. Keep them coming. Here's your takeaway.
She is a fascinating character. So fascinating, I put her in a musical.
Kitty Feldy from KPCC in Pasadena, talking about the LA Dodgers' 50th birthday. That's it for us.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.